We are at Milmstream House, Jamaica Road. The date is the 12th of July 2010. The interview is for the grandchildren of the Blitz Project. The name of the interviewers are Kezia Herzog and Asya Karababa, assisted by Robert Herzog. We are interviewing
Brenda Watkinson.
And can you spell that for me, please, Brenda?
Yes, B-R-E-N-D-A W-A-T-K-I-N-S-O-N.
Thank you. And the place and year of your birth?
26th of July, 1937, at 11 Raymouth Road, spelt R-A-Y-M-O-U-T-H. Raymouth Road, Bermondsey.
Thank you. And can I ask how old you were during the Blitz?
Well, I was born in 37, so I was 2 when the war started. The actual Blitz, as strictly speaking, is 1940, so I would be 3 then. But I lived in that house through till almost the end of the war, 1944. So I was between the ages of 2 and 6 during that period of the whole period of bombing.
Could you tell us a bit about what you liked doing when you were a child?
There were very few children left by the time I was allowed to go out and play, because everybody had been evacuated. There was just about half a dozen of us. And we played, funnily enough, we played on the Anderson shelters. The Anderson shelter is the shelter that saved our lives. And they were in the back garden. Each house in the terrace had an Anderson shelter. And being a bit of a tomboy, we quite liked climbing up on top of the shelters and showering each other with pebbles or whatever. Another thing, again tomboy, the next street, Aspinden Road, which is still there, as you go walk away from Raymouth Road and you're walking down Aspinden Road, to the right was completely bombed flat, and Gosnell's, spelled G-O-S-N-E-L-L apostrophe S, Gosnell's lorries used to park there, the trailers, and we used to love climbing, always climbing on the lorries and getting smothered in oil and tar, I'm afraid, and generally exploring the bomb site, which was very dangerous actually. I mean, there were great craters in parts of the bomb site. I can remember children trying to get down, and it was extremely dangerous. The other thing that we liked to do, I had an old bike given to me by my granddad. I don't know where on earth he got it from. It was a little tricycle. It had no tyres, no handlebars, and the noise as it went up and down the pavement between my home and the pub on the corner, which is still there, it's now been converted into flats, was called the Raymouth Tavern. I used to ride up and down there a lot, much to the annoyance of the neighbours. With the other children, we played skipping, but it was a reasonably main road, so we tended to just be in each other's gardens. We played skipping. I can remember, you know, children holding the rope at either end, and you'd jump in to the rope. I didn't much care for dolls and prams. I'm sorry, I always wanted a car. I was not a doll person. I was given a doll, but I really wasn't interested. So I was very interested. Reading was the main thing. My dad read to me every night, and I read this wonderful book called The Children's Wonder Book, which I knew from end to end practically. I was very interested in things like fairies. Now you'll laugh at this, but I was convinced in a book I'd read that that fairies came at night and did things in your home. And if you left some water out from them, they would leave you silver pennies. And only being about 4 or 5, 6 years old at the time I read this, I believed it all. And because I always wanted a car, in my little head I thought, maybe the fairies would like a car as well to save their wings. So I made them a car of paper. I sewed it all together. I can see it now. This little car, wheels sewn on. And I left it out on the back bedroom mantelpiece for them to drink. I left a glass of water at the side for them to drink. Well, obviously, my parents must have removed the car because I never saw it again. But I mean, in my imagination, I believed that they'd been and they'd driven off in the car. So, you see, there was no television, and we used our imagination a lot more, I think, than they probably do now. The other activity that was very popular with me was not with children, but it was actually in the shelters. We sheltered mostly in the railway arches, which are still there, on the other side of the road. It was the one that we used to use was a metalworking factory, sheet metal, and you're cutting metal for industry. And we went there at night for company, and this was heaven to me because I always wanted to entertain. Singing and dancing and being on the stage was my aim in life. So I pretended that I was in the theatre. I had no costume, of course, but it was all in the mind. I used to go a lot behind all the machinery and pretend that I was in my dressing room, and then I would come out and sing and dance to the people who were sheltering, and it cheered them up and it took their mind off the raid. And they would join in. So you see, you couldn't shut me up. That was my sort of entertainment for myself. Other games we played, I had a whip and top. I don't know if they make those now. You wind the thing and then you pull it, the top spins.
Yeah.
We played, of course, no one told you off if you put chalk on the pavement. We played hopscotch on the pavement. I don't know if people do that now. I'm trying to think what else we would have played. Card games, of course, board games, Ludo, snakes and ladders, that sort of thing. But there was a lot of reading that went on. That was I think that was what our main thing, having no, and of course there were parties with our piano. My mother played the piano. We're a very musical family. So I think they're the first things that come to mind is riding up and down on my noisy bike, much to the annoyance of the neighbours, fighting on the on top of the Anderson shelter, playing skipping out the back, and sometimes having a stirrup pump. We had a stirrup pump given to us by the government in case we caught fire with the bombs, and we used to water the garden with it, and sometimes my brother, who was 10 years older than I was, we would sort of turn the hose on each other, like you do. It's fun. Is that enough?
Yeah. Many things that you said, like skipping, singing and dancing, riding a bike, you would think that are fairly modern things now, but it goes to show that they did used to do stuff like this during the war.
Yes, that's how Petula Clark started. She was a big star in the 60s and 70s, and she started off in the air raid shelters. I think quite a lot of people did. They had to do something to cheer themselves up. Yes, and as you say, skipping, is that still popular?
Yeah.
Is it? Oh, well, I'm glad to hear that. It's healthy.
Could you tell us a bit about your family?
Yes, I lived, the house that I was born in was shared by myself and my brother, 10 years older than I was. Mum and Dad and my brother and I were on the downstairs part of this terraced house, and upstairs was my mother's father and mother. It was quite usual in those days to all live together as a family unit, the older generation. Before they moved in, we had lodgers from time to time upstairs, but that was our family, and unfortunately, there was such a huge gap between my brother and myself, it was almost like being an only child, really. When you've got a brother who's 10 years older than you, they really don't want to know. It's a wonder I'm still here. I mean, the neighbour, poor soul, when he was 10 years old and a baby sister was presented to him, he was not impressed, as you can imagine, and he was given the job of taking me out for walks in the pram, which didn't appeal to him at all. And one of my neighbours knocked at my mother's home and said, "If you're not careful, that child won't live to see 1 year old," because she'd seen him round the park with his head between the pram handles, charging along like a chariot, with me bobbing up and down in the middle. So that was his revenge on me. And then when he got to, not so long before we were bombed out, I was, so he would be 16, 17 then, and we were, again, he was just old enough, and I was old enough then, six, to take me around the park, and he would take me around the park. And he, at that point, I had a better bike given to me, which was really not supposed to be used. And again, he said, "Now you sit in the front, get your hands." He'd sit on the back and go like crazy, and I sort of sitting between the handlebars and his lap, and absolutely terrified. "Don't tell Mum, don't tell Mum," was all I could hear in my ear. You know, isn't it? There's not much companionship when you've got a big gap like that. The problem, reason there's a big gap, is my sister, who would have been the halfway mark, died at 3 months old in St Olive's Hospital, which is not so very long, been demolished and made into flats, just down by Rotherhithe Tunnel. And then there was another child, but she was aborted because my mother was dying. It's what they call an ectopic pregnancy. I don't know how you spell it, but you'll probably find it. And so that baby had to be removed, and I shouldn't have been here at all. My mother was told, "Well, there's one thing, you won't have any other children." And suddenly, hello, it's me. I was not welcome, I can tell you, because parents had had such dreadful economic circumstances. They were married in the year of the Depression and the general strike, 1926. Photograph is up on the wall. And they had most dreadful time economically. My father was in poor health immediately afterwards, and Mum was the breadwinner and producing my brother within a year. So to be the breadwinner and to be pregnant at the same time as your husband's out of work and in hospital, it's very difficult. So I was not welcome. In fact, she actually asked for me to be aborted, but the doctor refused. But I must have been determined to get here, I suppose. So that's why there's this big gap between my brother and myself. I only caught up with him at certain times of our life. Like, as I say, when I was six, before we were bombed out, in that year, we had some sort of little outings together. And then at the end of the war, he was in the army, when we'd gone back into this awful condemned house in Dulliford Road. When he came home on leave, he would take me roller skating, which was a great thing to do. And that was at Forest Gate. That's in what we now call the East End of London. So they were not. And then we're caught up with him again. He was sort of like a stranger. And I sort of caught up with him for short periods of time. When I was 18 and he was 28, he was living here. He wasn't yet courting. And we used to go dancing together. So that was nice as well. But it was only these short-lived periods that I had a brother, if you see what I mean, because of the circumstances of the age and the war, it kept separating us. So, because when we were bombed out, you see, we were separated completely. My mother and I were on our own. My brother and father were left in London, and my brother was living in the premises that were given to him by his employers, and that was in Beckenham. And my father was up at Fire Brigade headquarters. So there was these long years of separation. So really, I never felt as though I had a brother, really. You know, it's quite sad, really. But that was all the family I had, apart from Nan and Grandad upstairs.
Brenda, you said you were bombed out. Was this in Weymouth Road,
yes,
when you were living?
From Weymouth Road, that's correct.
And can you tell us what happened? Was the house actually destroyed and you had to move
somewhere
else?
No, it wasn't. It was still there certainly it was there in the year of the Queen's Silver Jubilee. I remember photographing the Weymouth Tavern and walking down the street, and the house was still there. I wish I photographed it. I have a photograph here from 1935, which I will show you, of King George V's Silver Jubilee, before I was born. There's the family outside the house. What happened was, I don't know to this day where the bomb fell. It's a mystery to me, because what happens, we were in the Anderson shelter all night, and pretty horrendous circumstances to get into this. I'll tell you that in a minute. But what happened was we were discovered there the next day at 8 o'clock in the morning, and the fire watchers, the boys who come round and check whether any fire bombs have been dropped, incendiary bombs, they put the fires out incendiary bombs, if you know about those. Yeah. And they came into the Anderson shelter and said, you know, the all clear's gone. And you know, did you know? We didn't know. All huddled together, and Mum said, I could have sworn I bolted the front door last night, but of course there's no front door there, because the house was blasted inside outside. Blast damage sort of goes in and out, doesn't it, Robert? They were telling us the other night at the launch party. And so all the inside was destroyed, you know, I mean, the ceilings were down, everything was thrown about and plaster everywhere. But the house stood, minus its front door. And people say, oh, you could leave your front doors open in those days. Not true. That house was looted even before we got out of the shelter. My brother's camera, which he's carefully saved up for, had gone when, you know, he's a teenager, you know, starting work, and well, he'd been working since he was 14. But he's been saving and saving for this lovely camera. It was in the front parlour, and which was on the street level, of course. It had gone, and a few other things had gone as well. It's amazing to me that people can do that when the house has just been bombed. And you know. But as I say, we got out with our lives, and for that we have to be thankful. We were all alive. The story of the night and how we survived is in a thing that Marigold's got a print up of it, and I've got one here as well, and I've put it on the BBC website. It's called Our Life-Saving Cat. It's the cat that saved our lives. But I won't go on with that unless you want to go on with some other questions. But that's how we were all saved, us and the people next door, by my mother.
After you were bombed out, did you move straight into this house?
No. We were out. We had no home. Oh. The government had what they called rest centres. Okay. Ours was Creedon Road School, Credon, which is actually in Creedon Road. I don't think it's there nowadays. I don't think so. It was the school hall. We were just taken there with what we stood up in, my mother and I, and we slept on the floor, just on bare boards, for about a week or so. And then the government found us a home, in a home. It was run by the American Air Force. It was funded by them, I should say. It was funded by the American Air Force, and it was in Woking in Surrey. That's W-O-K-I-N-G, Woking in Surrey. It was absolutely appalling because I was taken there at night and my mother was removed from me. I had no idea where I was going. I was absolutely terrified. I was still only six. And I was taken into this, well, I thought it was a dormitory. Looking back, I suppose it was just a very large room. It was no lights on because the other children there were asleep, and my clothes were taken off me, much to my aggravation and crying and screaming, don't take my clothes off me, you know, where's my mum, all this sort of thing. And when I woke up the next morning, I discovered that I was in a room full of other little children, and they were told, oh, we've got a big girl with us now, she can look after you. I was six. These little children were aged between about 2 and 4. And what I discovered, we were in a house which, and each mother or aunt or grandmother, whoever it was that the children had come with, had to be a female relative. They were all deposited in another house on the other side of a park. And we were told, you can see auntie, mother, whoever it was, for 2 hours next Wednesday. On a Wednesday afternoon, you can visit with your relative. And you try telling that to very young children, it's a million years away. It was one of the worst parts of my life, and it's also in my story. I put it on the web. It was so awful, and the elders, I discovered afterwards, were half starved. the money was being funding from the Americans to give lots of food, and they weren't getting it. It was being diverted, maybe the black market. You've possibly heard of the black market. I don't know. People sold stuff privately that they shouldn't have been selling. And it was just an awful time. So my mother quickly got us out of there. But the time that she was there, she spent her time trying to find somewhere else, a lodging house. And she found us a lodging house, and that was equally terrible. We were only there a matter of weeks, a pretty awful family. That was also somewhere in the environs of Woking. And by this time, my grandparents, who'd been upstairs and bombed out with us, because of their age, they weren't expected to be sent round to these other lodgings. They were found a flat, a council flat, in Bermondsey, in a street called Decimus Street, which is just off Towbridge Road. So they were deposited there, and what we did, we came back and we lived with Grandma for a while, so that's three different places already. And but at the end of that period, we couldn't stay there long, there wasn't any room for us. We were like refugees, really. We were refugees. My father wrote to his uncle in Diss in Norfolk. That's spelled D-I-S-S. And that's in Norfolk, and just south of Norwich. And he had his own house, beautiful house, in its own grounds. He owned the land as well as the house. And we lived there from a year, from the end of 44, after all this toing and froing between... We were bombed out in June 44, so we had a number of... a few months of, you know, zip, dip, 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 dip. And then we went to Diss, and we lived with my uncle till not very long before the war finished. So it'd be early... we were there a year, so I'm a bit hazy onto the timings now. We must have gone there at the late... Yes, we did go there in the late summer. I remember now, because it was boiling hot in the train. It was full of soldiers. You couldn't move for soldiers being moved. And, yeah, that's right. So we were there 10 months, I think, exactly. Back we came again. We'd had enough of being separated. And by this time, my mother managed to lodge us with my aunt who lived in Bellingham. That's B-E-L-L-I-N-G-H-A-M. That's down near Bromley. She was living down there, so we lodged in with her. And after that, we moved, not long before the war ended, my father found us this condemned house in Delaford Road. And Delaford Road has been completely rejigged now. You can't recognise it. But it's just off Ilderton Road. Do you know Ilderton Road? I-L-D-E-R-T-O-N. And Delaford, D-E-L-A-F-O-R-D, that's just off it. It's the first right as you go down towards Old Kent Road. And we lived in this awful house. Well, I say awful because it was very wet. Everything was rusty, it was so wet. That's why it was condemned. It should not have been inhabited. But my father had managed to find it, as with the help of the council, I suppose, and put out what furniture we got left. He'd put it into this house, and then we would be reunited with our furniture, if you follow me. But at least Mum was reunited with her husband, and that's very important. And we stayed there, and that's where we had the VE party, which I've got photos of as well, in the street, at the street party. And in 48, so we were there 3 years, the government requisition, that means they forced the owners of flats in this block to give them up to people who'd been made homeless. So basically we were homeless from June 44 till May 48, exactly 4 years, and that's when we moved in here, been here ever since. So quite a colourful period of bump, 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 you know. It's like if it's Wednesday, it must be, you know, those sort of periods. Quite disconcerting for a child. But, you know, we live through it. And there we are. We live through it. We're still here. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you.
There's a lot of it, isn't there? But, well, you know.
I was just wondering, Brenda, when you see, obviously your house got bombed out, as you've explained, did your family ever consider evacuating you out to the countryside?
Absolutely not.
And why was that? Could you...
My mother had a mantra all through the Blitz. She was always saying and referring to it in years afterwards. Oh no, if we go, we all go together. If anybody was killed, we'd got to all be killed together so that nobody was left behind. And you come to think of it, that's a pretty tall order, isn't it? I didn't think about that until I was about in my 40s, and she repeated it. And I was in my 40s living here with her, and I said, you know, Mum, that's a bit harsh, isn't it? So in other words, if you got killed, I've got to be killed as well. You know, but that was her idea. And also, I think she'd heard some pretty horrendous stories of evacuees. Some came back because they weren't treated very well. Some were treated brilliantly and they had a lovely time. Others were not treated brilliantly, and I think that was her fear. So, she never considered it. There were not very many children left, really, in Bermondsey, but I did go to school at 6 years old. I had almost a year at Gallywall Road School.
Okay, thank you, Brenda. We're going to move on from that subject now, and we're going to go on to artefacts and possessions. Could you tell me a bit about any of the artefacts you still have from the Second World War and about any possessions you might have had during the Blitz?
Yes, I have one here. It'll crackle. It'll I have with me, to show you, maybe you can even use it in the show, the dressing gown, hooded dressing gown that my mother used to put on me if we didn't have time to get to the shelter across the way in the Arches, and or sometimes there wasn't a warning. There wasn't a warning the night we were bombed out. That's why it was all chaotic. My mother would put this on quickly over my nightdress, and it's a hooded dressing gown, a thick plush material, and that for some reason she kept, and I've got that here with me. I know there's a ration book somewhere. We used to have a police whistle, but I think that we were ordered to hand it in some years ago. You're not allowed to keep police whistles. My father was a fire watcher in his time off from the fire service. They had 48 hours on and 48 hours off. I know he had a police whistle. A lot of my home is so old that there are things like, not related to the Blitz, but just old equipment. I mean, some of the stuff that's in the kitchen is from that period, the 40s, very low tech. Amazing to look at, and I'll show you afterwards. But that's not sort of related, it's just of the period. But if you were to walk around my home, you'd find something in every room. There's all sorts of things. But that's the main thing that I've got, and of course I've got photographs as well, which I'll show you as well. Excuse my eye, it keeps leaking, driving me up the pole. I think that's about all I can tell you as to what remains from the Blitz, because everything was left in the house. And all we got out was the furniture, which there's the piano, that's from pre-war, and my mother's bedroom suite. I think that's about all we had.
Okay, thank you for that, Brenda. Could you tell us a bit about your experience of school during the Blitz?
Well, I didn't go to school until I was six. That was the starting age then, so, I mean, time I got to school, we weren't there very long before we lost our home and we were off on our travels. I went to school there, Gallywall Road. You know Gallywall Road?
I don't think so.
Yes, that's Gallywall. It's called that because that is where the Romans used to moor their galleys, their boats, when we were occupied by the Romans. Yeah, so it's the wall of where the galleys were. I went to school there for a little while, and then went to school in Diss. And then by the time I got back, we went back to Gallywall again, once we got back into... I didn't go to school at any of these other places until I got back here and went to Gallywall until we came here in 48. And then I went to the Aylwin Grammar School after that, so... I didn't really have a lot of schooling, but I was well ahead of the others when I did join the class, because I was taught at home. My parents were just so good at reading and English, and you know, I could read. I mean, my party trick was to read the Encyclopedia Britannica at 6 years old, which is full of very long words. That was my party trick. That's about all I can tell you about the schooling.
Could I just ask a question about this, the schooling aspect? What happened to children who might have been a bit older in the war? Were schools sort of used in the war? Were schools?
Yes, but I mean, as I said, the galley wall was open, but I wasn't able to go there until I was six. I mean, obviously there was a class full of children already there. Yeah. Oh yes, I mean they just had their schooling. It's just that the starting age was much later then than it is now. I mean, and now you have preschool as well, don't you? Oh no, they had a normal schooling. If the school wasn't bombed, and presumably some of the people that I'd met, children I suppose that I'd met when I was six, I probably caught up with again when I got back into 45. I'd be eight then. I probably, you know, some of the children were still there in the higher classes. I'm sure we were there till I was 11, when we had they used to call it the 11 plus. Oh yes, the children went to school, but as I said, we just started later.
Okay, thank you, Brenda. Could you tell me a bit about your experience of evacuation?
No, I wasn't evacuated, no.
Okay, could you tell us a bit about your memories of rationing during the Second World War?
Well, people say about rationing, I was never hungry. Can tell you that, but looking back, I guess my parents probably were, because you had very small amounts of meat and cheese and that sort of thing. I can remember eating plenty of meat. I can remember roast lamb being one of my favourites, and certainly I was never hungry. But sweets were rationed, and I could. But yet, strangely enough, I can remember. Two of my favourite snacks when children get hungry around about the middle of the afternoon and it's not yet time for the next meal, I can remember sitting on the back doorstep and being given one of my favourite snacks was just bread and sugar. Sugar sandwich. Can you imagine that now? Bread and sugar. Delicious. Or bread and condensed milk. Or bread and syrup. Those were favourite snacks. Fill up the small stomach, you know, and I don't remember any sweets until I was at Woking, and on one of these afternoons, these Wednesday afternoons, when I was able to meet my mother, I had my seventh birthday on that Wednesday afternoon, and that was the first sweet I can remember, and looking back, I know what it was Maltesers, and I thought I'd never tasted anything so delicious in all my life, these little chocolate balls what is it inside? The honeycomb. And I didn't know what they were. I can remember to this day, my mother unwrapping this for my, well, it's part of my birthday present, these sweets. After that, when we got back, there was a limited amount of sweets allowed on your coupons. And so when we were living back in Delaford Road, which was from 45, early 45. Rationing didn't stop until some years after the war. We were still on rations. And I can remember such things as sherbet lemons were one of my favourites. cigarettes. Licorice cigarettes. Pretend cigarettes. Crazy. There was a shop on the corner in Ilderton Road that sold the most delicious ice lollies. And I know why they were delicious. She made them in egg cups, put a stick in them, put them in the fridge, and the egg cup was just filled with undiluted squash, which made the most delicious orange lollipops. Absolutely beautiful. I'm trying to think what else, other sweets that I had. Palm toffee. My father was always buying us palm toffee. Palm was the brand. But sherbet. And my mother, because ice cream wasn't really available or difficult to get hold of, my mother made ice cream. Can you believe? She found a recipe, and whereby, it was a very cold old damp house, as I said, and she found this recipe. She could make something with like pretend ice cream. It was in a block. It must have been made out of custard powder and I don't know, other kinds of dried milk or something. And it was in a block, and then she'd put it up in this cupboard until it got really cold, and then you could cut it. And she used to actually buy the wafers, ice cream. I don't know if you have ice cream wafers now, do you? Oh, you do. Mm-hmm. So about so big, and you have ice cream in the middle. And she and all the kids from the street used to come in to have some of Mrs. Watkinson's ice cream, and it was delicious. What she made it out of, I do not know, but it was lovely. It had a lovely vanilla flavour, and of course, it wasn't frozen. It was just very cold. But you see, there were lots of wartime recipes to make up for the fact that you hadn't got the real thing. And so that was one of the pretend ice creams. But I do remember, as I say, the other rationing I wasn't really aware of, because I think lots of parents probably just cut themselves short and gave enough to the children. That's what I think. I don't know. But certainly there was enough meat, because I can clearly remember the Sunday joint being cut and me asking for the fat. Because would you believe I loved fat? And I used to call my brother Albie. His name was Albert. He hated fat. We were like Jack Sprat and his wife. I don't know if you know that nursery rhyme. Jack Sprat would eat no fat, his wife would eat no lean. And so between them both, you see, they licked the platter clean. And that was exactly like us. And I used to say to my mother, oh, let me have Albert's fat, it's leaner than mine. I used to eat all this fat and crackling. And so, yeah, I know we had normal food. And of course, the desserts were made at home. In fact, now this, you're talking about artifacts from the war, I used an old recipe book from the 1920s, which my mother used to use. I used it this week. I'll show you in a minute. It's a tiny little book from Atora Suet, which is obviously still sold. I bought the light Atora, and I made I brought them back from Norfolk, fresh gooseberries and red currants, because you can't buy those in the supermarkets up here. And I made myself a gooseberry and red currant suet pudding from a pre-war book, which was used a lot during the war. It's a lovely little book. Yeah. So, yes, as I say, I couldn't sort of think of particular artifacts. It's just that the whole home is full of old bits and pieces, some of which I still didn't use. And none the worse for that, I can tell you. It was delicious.
Just going back to rationing again, Brenda. Were you aware of, I mean, obviously you're too young to appreciate the drinking culture, but were you aware that people would still go to the public houses? Were they still around?
Yes.
Was alcohol rationed or anything?
Well, you see, my parents both suffered at the hands of their parents who drank too much in the 20s. And they, Mum and Dad, found each other because they both wanted, that was ambitious, to find a partner who didn't drink. They weren't teetotalers, they weren't prudes. We had parties, and then there would be drink in the home, but only very, very limited amount, because the party was mainly singing, dancing, and eating. There was always a good table of food spread out. So there'd be the men would have a glass of beer. My uncle and aunt would come down, Nan and Grandad, and they would have a glass of beer. But people in my family circle didn't go out to drink. Dad never went to the pub at all. But after the war, when we would have a Sunday afternoon walk, I can remember very clearly that if we passed a pub, and by the time the end of the afternoon, the pub had opened, Dad would often say, oh, just wait outside, I'm going to go in for a glass of ale. He would just, sometimes there was a pub with a garden out the back, but it would just be a glass of ale. And at Christmas, there would be a bottle of port opened. But locally, there would be pubs, but you see, so many men were in the army or fighting the fires in London. They didn't really have, I don't think they had much time to go to the pub. And I certainly never saw anybody drunk until like recent times. Funnily enough, one of the pubs, I can remember walking through the park, my pop going in there for a little while I stood outside, was next door. And looking up at this very flat, which was bombed, This flat didn't exist. And when you go out, if you look at the plaque that's in the bottom of the building, and then you'll look up, you'll see there's a gargoyle from the Houses of Parliament at the top of the building, and it tells you that this side was bombed in the, I forget, it was during the war, and it was rebuilt just before we moved in here. So our flat is a rebuilt part of the building. And the strange thing was, my mother used to look up at this flat, so I'd like to live there. Isn't it funny? But no, that's the way we drank, in as much as drink was at home, but only for parties. And certainly I didn't know anyone who went to the pub. I think people were just too busy trying to stay alive, really. I'm sure they did drink, yes. I mean, pubs, you know, obviously were open, but the men were busy, and, you know, a lot of the children were away. You had to fend for yourself, didn't you?
So, rationing.
Yes.
So obviously, like, clothes were rationed as well.
Yes, that didn't bother me at all. Because my mother was a dressmaker in her part time. And they were poor, my parents, they were poor, but they didn't have to go out and buy cloth. My mother was a great community person. What she did, she would do work for other people in the borough, and then they would pay her in cast off clothing, like you have charity shop now, they didn't exist. But they would give her the clothing of their older children for me. But I never had cast offs, as we call them. What I had, my mother would take the clothes to pieces. She could cut her own patterns. She was wonderfully gifted. She would dye the material to an appropriate colour for a younger child. She would cut a completely different pattern out of it and make it for me. I never had anything from a shop until I was 14. And that was everything. All the inner clothes, all the underclothes, the frocks, the hats, the coats, even the socks were knitted. So, and my mother would make things for even my older brother. She made jackets, she made shirts. And when a tailor once saw her work, he said to her, "Who taught you to turn a collar?" Turning a collar is a skilled thing. She said, "No one. She taught herself." Her work was wonderful. And she was paid. She got her materials from people in the community who couldn't afford to pay her. This was a very poor community where we live now, Bermondsey. And so there was a lot of help, one to another, you see. And I was 14 before I had a pair of ordinary bought socks. I thought it was wonderful to have thin socks. I'd had these knitted socks all my life. And so we weren't really bothered by the... And of course, she made her own clothes as well. I think she bought some... Well, she did buy some of her clothes, yes. My father wasn't bothered by the rationing because he was kitted out by the fire service. And my brother started work at 14, so he had some wages to buy his clothes with. Apparently, his first day's work, he went to work at 14, wearing a trilby hat. Can you imagine? A trilby hat at 14, you must have looked so sweet. But she made his clothes as well, his shirts, all sorts of things. So we were very, very fortunate that to have a gifted mother. It's wonderful, really.
What did you do for shoes?
Oh, shoes were bought, of course, yes. Okay. Obviously, shoes had to be bought, yes.
Earlier you mentioned about bombing.
So about which?
Bombing.
Oh, the bombing, yes.
So could you tell us a bit about your memories?
My main memory of the bombing was either of being screaming terrified, because I was old enough, just intelligent enough, I suppose, to realise that we were about to be killed from the skies. I knew what the bombs were. I mean, maybe a little child wouldn't have done, I don't know. By the time the Blitz started, that was 1940, I was three. But I was very well aware. Excuse me, this eye is driving me mad. Perhaps you could turn the fan off, could you, please? By the 40s, I was old enough to realise that we were in danger. And my memories were being terrified all the time. The only place I wasn't terrified was when we went across into the railway arches, and there all the business of singing and dancing took over my head, and I forgot all about the bombs. And one night everybody was joining in. They were having such a good time because I got everybody singing. By this time I was about four, and the air raid warden came in and said, why are you all still here? Do you know what time is? No, nobody had realised what time it was. The all clear went ages ago. What are you all still doing here? And they'd been singing and enjoying themselves so much they didn't go to sleep. They didn't realise the all clear had gone. So it's a complete contrast of my reaction to the bombing. Either I was busy entertaining, da, 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 you know, this is me, hello. Or if not, on the night that we actually bombed out, I can see it now, it's as if it was yesterday. We were standing screaming in the garden because my mother again put this dressing gown on me quickly first, said go down to the shelter while I get everybody else up. There was no air raid warning, as there should have been. The siren didn't go. It was the cat that she realised was behaving strangely. It was 2 o'clock in the morning. My mother was whitewashing the back scullery ceiling at 2 o'clock because my father was at the fire station and everybody else was in bed. So she was getting on. She was a bit of a night owl anyway. And she noticed the cat and she realised there was something was going to happen because animals can tell you when there's danger coming. And she got me out, but I wouldn't go into the shelter because my mother was still in the house trying to get my brother up, trying to get Grandma and Grandpa up and get them dressed upstairs. And also getting the next door people up, which was terrible because everybody was dead to the world in the middle of the night. They wouldn't wake up. So my memory then was of being absolutely petrified and screaming my head off and my mother to come down and just bawling back to me, go down to the shelter. And I, no, 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 you come. So extremes of memory. Another night I remember, two nights, the blackout. My mother had me in her arms, so I must have been, again, not much past three, since the early part of the war, which is to say the Blitz actually started in 1940, so I'd probably be about three then, so she was carrying me. And if you walk along the other side of Rames Road, you'll see that it's where all the entrances are to where the sheet metal works were, and then they're private businesses. There's a bit of pavement, and then there's a gap, and there's a bit of pavement, and then there's a gap. In the blackout, she fell up the pavement, fell up the curb, and landed on top of me and completely winded both of us. And I can remember being squashed underneath her. Neither of us were injured, but that's a very strong memory of falling in the blackout. And also because of the bombing. And also one another night, we were all taken out of the railway arches and put on a lorry and taken, I cannot remember where, that's where the memory goes. I can remember vividly coming out of there on an open lorry with everything on fire around us. That's all where we went, I don't know, but looking back, they must have been the incendiary bombs that were dropped before the other bombs started, and they started fires. And it was like hell. It was like a vision of hell, being driven with all these other children and grown-ups in an open lorry surrounded by fire. But those are my four main memories, entertaining, being frightened, being squashed flat on the pavement, and being driven through the fire.
Thank you for that.
You can ask, you mentioned before you had a garden, is that correct?
Oh, yes.
So you had an Anderson shelter in your
garden. In the garden, that's
right. But
yes.
Also you had these shelters under the railings. Is that right? You had two shelters.
The shelters that I'm talking about entertaining were the premises of the sheet metal workers who were under the railway arches on the opposite side of Weymouth Road. So we were in commercial premises, not shelters. We were in commercial premises. They just let us go in there for company. So those were our two forms of shelter. The row of houses all had an Anderson shelter in the back garden, which saved our lives. and as I said earlier, for company, because they were cold, those Anderson shelters, and cramped when you've got Nan and Grandad as well, sort of like this. So we had the two options. And what we used to do on reflection, I think what we did, we went to the sheet metal workers under the railway arches when there was time, when there was a warning, and all the neighbours were going, well, hello, we're going over there now. You know, we all went across in the blackout. Or if there wasn't time, like that night, when there was no warning, we would dive into the Anderson shelter. So there were two options, yeah. Now, we didn't have anything in the front. There wasn't a front garden. Terraced house was just concrete front.
Yeah, thank you for that, Brenda. Could you, like you've been telling us a bit before, could you tell us a bit more about your experience of air raid shelters during the Blitz?
Well, they were, as I said, they were very cramped. The Anderson shelter was very cramped, and you had to, you couldn't sleep in there. Well, I suppose you could sleep sitting up if you're lucky, but you had to find things to do. So I used to read, and my mother, would you believe, taught my brother to knit. My mother was a great knitter, and she saw nothing wrong in a chap being taught to knit. So he, at this period, we were bombed out when I was six, so he'd be 16, and around that time, I can remember him being taught to knit in the shelter, and he knitted beautifully. I can't knit for toffee. My mother tried to teach me after the war. She said she couldn't make out why none of the rows came out the same length. I had no skill, but my brother knitted beautifully. As I said, I think I've really covered the experiences of the shelters in what I've said before. The community shelter, which was not a proper shelter, was just commercial premises, the sheet metal workers' premises, they were very happy places in a way, because everybody was trying to cheer everybody else up, and it was a nice atmosphere. It was like having one big family, really. And there was cocoa made. I can remember so vividly this little lady who used to bring us a big jug of cocoa. Where she made it, goodness, you know, but she brought it from the home, maybe, which was only across the street. But you know, we were looked after by ourselves, our own efforts, people pulled together. And I can always remember when it was coming up to cocoa time, I'd be up the front of the queue, be fond of cocoa. And I can remember saying to her, little lady, because I never knew anybody's name, I still don't know anyone's name, little lady, pour the cocoa out. And that sort of became a family joke for years afterwards. Do you remember saying, little lady, pour the cocoa out? But it was very, sociable. It's a very sociable atmosphere, and people did what they could to cheer each other up, you know, chatting, telling jokes until they went to sleep. Of course, they had nothing to sleep on, just what you brought over with you, maybe a cushion or something. I mean, this is the point. You had to try and get to sleep. If it was a long raid, some of the raids would go on all night, and people would try to sleep. But, I mean, you just took with you what you could find to sleep on, cushions and so forth. So it was very much uncomfortable, but at least the Weymouth Road arches were drier than the shelter in the back garden. We never had a staircase that you could put in proper houses. I believe some people had a different kind of shelter they could put in their house called a Morrison shelter, but I don't know anything about that. But not having that kind, they were bigger houses. Ours was just a terraced house, yeah. So that, I think I covered what I can remember of the sheltering conditions. But I think we just had to sleep, you know, sitting up in the Anderson shelter. You just hoped that it wasn't too big a raid, too long a raid. Some of them went on an awfully long time.
So how long are we talking about? Like 8 to 10 hours? Or?
Well, all night, some of them. You know, you'd go over in the evening, and it would be daylight when you came out. It just depended. If you heard the all clear, then it might only be a few hours, you know, a couple of hours or 3 hours. But you see, then again, people were afraid to come back out in case we had another raid afterwards. They came back again, the bombers. So you tended, once you were over there, to stay there all night until it was daylight, and then you could come back. Of course, there were daylight raids as well. Another place we sheltered, I can remember again, one without warning, was diving under the table in the what we called the kitchen. Nowadays people call it the living room. But I can remember diving on, you know, you just sheltered where you could. But at least we had more room. People who were in proper air raid shelters, so I'm told, often had horrendous experiences because they were too many people went down the stairs to go in, and sometimes people fell over on top of each other in their rush. Some people were actually killed in that way. There was a very big incident over in, is it Golders Green, I think? No, the East End, wasn't it? In the East End somewhere. There were hundreds were killed, where somebody tripped at the bottom, people were rushing down, and everybody else fell on top of them. That was awful. But so we were actually safer where we were, because it was all on the level, it was on ground level, you see, and there was plenty of room in this street sheet metal working premises.
You mentioned before that your brother was 10 years older. Was he ever interested in joining the war effort as a soldier?
Yes, he was in the Air Training Corps. Yeah, as soon as he was old enough. By the time, just after we were bombed out, while I was in Woking, I reached my 7th birthday. His birthday was a few months ahead of me, so he was already 17, and he joined the Air Training Corps. Yeah, that's like a junior RAF, that's right, and he was given time off work to do that. And that he kept on doing. What he did, I don't know, because we were living all over the place. We didn't really aware of what he was doing. Obviously, he was doing whatever he was told to do by the government in the Air Training Corps. We didn't catch up with him till we got back to Bermondsey in Delaford Road in, that would be probably early 45, because we weren't there very long before the war ended. And by that time, so there I'm 8, so he's 18, he's called up. He was in the Royal Armoured Corps, that's otherwise known as the Tank Corps. And he stayed as a soldier for 3 years. So first he was in the Air Training Corps as a teenager, and then into the army I think he was a tank driver. But he didn't go out because the war was coming to an end. He stayed in England. But yes, he was involved in the war effort. Yeah, yeah.
And so might be a bit. Don't mind, it's too personal, but is your brother still alive today?
No, sadly not. He died quite young, 66 years of age, in 1993. So he's been dead quite a while now.
Okay, I'm sorry about that.
And my father, of course, fought the Blitz right the way through. He wanted to join the RAF, and he wasn't allowed because he was completely deaf in one ear. So he became part of the fire service. It was called the AFS when he joined, and then it became the National Fire Service, the NFS. And he was posted up at the Fire Brigade headquarters on Lambeth Embankment. And he stayed there right till he was 74. He was the same age as the year, so in other words, 73. He was a veteran. He after he'd finished with the war effort, I mean, and that was really something, to be fighting the fires with the bombs falling around, it was pretty horrendous. But he had a charmed life, my mother said. When he wasn't doing that, again with the war effort, he was on fire watching. So when he had his time off during the time we were bombed out and after, because we left him behind, you see, he would be doing fire watching in this area, so he'd have 48 hours on and 48 hours off. And time and again, he just walked away from a corner that he'd been standing on, and a bomb fell there just afterwards, so he wasn't meant to die. It was extraordinary, really. And then after that, he was a storeman driver up at Fire Brigade headquarters, right until he stayed on there right until he was 73. So he had an extraordinary career with the fire service. But that was the the two men's contribution to the war, fighting the fires and fire watching. And when the war had finished, before we came back, Dad worked when his time off, but we were still in Dis. He worked at the Regal Old Kent Road as a commissionaire down there. A lot of them did that. Firemen. If they had a half a day off or something, they would work in the cinemas. But that was my brother's contribution. Yes, he was demobbed up there. That's his demob suit. He'd just come out of the army, so he would have come out in 40. He must have come out in 45, 46, 47 years. He was in the three that years, that's right. And he was out for some time before we got moved into here. So that would have been 1947. But sadly, he's dead now. I've got no family left. Father died in 75, mother in 87, and my brother in 93. So they're all gone now.
And you've never married yourself, have you?
No. I've lived here with my parents until they died, and just kept the flat on. Most convenient place to live.
Is there anything else you want to ask? We've covered most of the topics here. I think maybe you did want to ask about them. This kind of, I know the sheet metal arches because they're still there.
Which?
Those arches you're talking about.
Yes, they're still there. I think they've just been sold off now, the land, because I see that there's boarding gone up. And they were talking about, what do they call it? Rail track. Rail track was sell it part of the railway company, wasn't it?
Well, last time I've been down there, there's still been like commercial arches, you said. I mean, was it? That sounds quite fun, this like big community all together on the arches. And you much prefer that role than the U Anderson shelter.
Oh, yes. Who wants to be in an Anderson shelter? You know, cold and, well, you were frightened. You were just sort of huddled together. I mean, my recollection is it being a place not much bigger than what we're sitting now, you know, sort of squashed. But maybe it was bigger than I thought, but it just felt very squashed. Yeah.
So was the arches like quite far away from where you
were? On the other side of the road.
Oh, okay.
Literally on the other side of the road. That's when my mother fell over in the blackout, you see, crossing over with me in her arms from one side of Weymouth Road to the other. She fell over these curbs getting into the railway arches, yes. When I say railway arches, it was inside, you know, it was the commercial premises were underneath the railway, if you see what I mean, actually underneath the railway. Of course, the railway didn't run at night, so... But of course, we were a bit stupid when I came to think back. That's what they were trying to hit. We never thought of that. We never thought of that.
Well, it's a miracle you're still here, Brenda.
I intended to come and stay, didn't I? First, I was tried to be got rid of when I was, you know, before I was born. It's amazing that I ever got here. And then going through the Blitz, there must have been some purpose to my life. I'm still trying to find out what it was.
So would you say because you were a child, you think your memories are... Obviously, it was a hard time. But you think, you know, if you'd been older, your memories would have been less happy. Do you think being a child was kind of quite nice in a war, in a way? You see what I mean?
Well, I suppose it would have been... less safe. If you'd been grown up and going out to work, you'd be travelling across London, wouldn't you? You would be more at risk having to go to a place of work, you know, keep moving about. I mean, there were quite a lot of daylight raids. You never knew when they were coming. Sometimes there would be a siren and people would rush off to the nearest public shelter. But yeah, in a way, I guess that I was safer by being a child. I mean, even having to go to school, I'd have to walk round to Gallywall Road. So you were exposed. And, of course, in those days, you didn't go walking with your parents like they do now, and everyone's so cosseted now. I mean, when I was in Delaford Road and going to Gallywall Road School, I just walked there and to the Aylwin, you know, when I was living here. It's quite a long way, but nowadays, everyone's taking me away by car. So I guess really, yes, we were a bit safer by not... my mother was working down the Blue, as I was when I was a child, she was in food, and then subsequently, well, not when I was, but when I was a baby, really, I was looked after by my grandparents in Camilla Road. She went back to work for a little while. She worked in Albion Street. She worked in the butchers in Jamaica Road. So she had to move about. But once I got, I suppose, after I was no later than two, she was at home as a housewife. But that's the only thing I can think of, is that you were more exposed to the bombing if you were grown up. Yeah.
And you mentioned before that in your area, you said that a lot of kids had been evacuated, so you were kind of...
There was only about half a dozen of us. I can name them now, you know. We lived adjacent to each other in this little row of houses. There was Jeannie Atkins, and then there was a spinster who didn't have any children, and then there was us at number 11, just myself. Next door was Donald. Next door to him was Tony Bowden. And round the corner in Aspindham Road was Bernice. And that was it. That was the only children I knew.
Quite a little gang there.
Yeah.
And have you kept in contact with these people?
No, I wish I had. Well, funnily enough, I met up with Tony when I was 21. I met him at a social club in the 50s. Oh, we're starting the noise. We met up for a little while, but he's moved away now. See, those houses were refurbished. They were mended up. And let again, and that the Bowden family, two doors along, went back and lived there, and he was certainly still there in the early 70s, so the houses were habitable. They've been pulled down now to make place for some sort of homeless people's dwelling or nursing home or something. I'm not sure what it is, because I'm always in the car when I go down there. But no, I never got in touch with, and I never saw any of them again except Tony. Yeah, there's just that one person, yeah. And we were friends for a couple of years. And then I think what it was, the branch of that club closed, and I sort of lost touch with him, you know. It was just a local social club. Yeah, I wish really that I... He's still alive. There's one lady who works in the charity shop down the blue, Lil. And I know her. She lives across the road. And she, funny enough, I knew her through a friend of mine who was working with her at one time. And apparently she's his auntie. I don't know if she's auntie by relative or just called auntie. But it's so funny that she, you know, I met her through another friend who doesn't even live in London now. And met her and therefore hear that he's still... around, moved away from London. I don't know where he is now, but married and moved away, you know. But, you know, I said to her only a few weeks ago, do remember me to Tony. Yeah, I'd love to meet him again. But, and as I say, only this lady who works in the mine shop knows where he is. But I've never sought him out. I mean, I've said, say hello from me. But, I mean, you know, he's never contacted me. Well, why would people? I mean, you know... People move on, don't they? Their lives change.
You said earlier that you lived across the road from a shelter underneath an arch.
Yes, it wasn't a shelter, it was the commercial premises, okay. Yeah.
Was that because you were very lucky to live across the road?
Absolutely. Absolutely, yes. I'm just walk across the road. Mm-hmm. But bearing in mind it was usually in the blackout. That was the dangerous bit, crossing the road in the blackout, yeah. Yeah, we were lucky, really. Luckier than those people who had to get to public shelters downstairs. I think they were pretty awful places, and often, I believe, very overcrowded. Other people sheltered in the underground stations. But I think, we were quite lucky when I think about it.
Okay, thank you, Brenda, for your interview. Thank you.